Welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. This conversation is with Ugo Ekyo, whom I just met in Great Britain, and he was a former English professional footballer, and if you're in the States, you would call him a soccer player, in a long career from 1989 to 2009. And at the time I met him, he was the coach of the Tottenham Hotspur under 23 team. Ugo had this inner brilliance, this humility and thoughtfulness that was apparent right from the first interaction. It was the handshake and the eye contact that gave it away. And it was the combination of the way that he carried himself, but also it was the words that he chose. And maybe even more striking was the care that he took to choose the words to find the most authentic way to express what he's come to understand. Ugo and I were not able to finish this conversation, and it's heartbreaking. And it's for two reasons. The first made sense. He needed to run out into the field and begin his coaching for his under 23 team. And the second one is harder to process. Ugo passed away at the age of 44 before we were able to reconnect. And I think probably a lot of people would say before they were able to reconnect with him, which is the tragic part of it. I can only imagine what it's like for his wife and his family, you know, his children. And so with the highest regard for the man that I briefly met and condolences to his family, I did as much reading as I possibly could to understand his life and his death. And so many of the people that commented on who he is, players and coaches and friends, they described him as a great player and a wonderful human. So I feel fortunate to have this conversation and to have a brief interaction with him. And I'm honored to be able to hopefully celebrate his genius. And it does come through in the short time that we spent together. Thank you, Ugo, for the time that we spent sharing your insights and reminding us all of how important it is to love. How are you?
Good. Anxious.
Yeah, so I get that response a bit from people. And the anxiousness for you is, where does that come from?
I don't know. The unknown. What layers are going to be peeled off?
Yeah.
How deep we go, how deep I go, how deep you question.
Isn't that it, though? Isn't that the part where we start to really get real, is knowing that there's so many layers that we have, and am I going to go or not go? Am I going to explore or not explore?
Yeah, how much am I going to truthfully reveal? Am I going to hold some back? What am I going to hold back?
And how much do I want to keep private?
Hmm.
Yeah. So let's start with the obvious. Like, how did you deal with anxiousness as being a top player for a long time?
I guess I didn't really feel that anxious.
Not in sport.
Not really. No. Whilst playing,
yeah.
I felt, because I worked hard, I felt I was fitter than most. I felt I was as quick as most. And I was probably more dedicated than most. And that gave me a superior feeling, knowing that if I prepared right, I wouldn't have too many issues. There was never really a fear of going out and not hitting the right standard, because no matter how good or bad I was, I'd analyze and then I'd watch back again.
Were you genetically gifted from a young age that you were bigger, faster, stronger? Or did you have some combination of that high work ethic with some genetic coding?
Yeah, probably the latter. I was 14, 15. I was skinny. Lanky would be the word that most people would use. Skinny, long arms, long legs. And I left home at about 15, 16, that'd be. And then I got into a professional club. And I ate loads, I trained loads, and it was an opportunity I'd never expected in my dreams.
Okay, so in soccer, in what we'll call football, but American soccer, you were not part of an academy program?
No.
No, so no. You got spotted at a relatively old
late
age.
Yeah, so yeah. I was 15, which is quite late.
Yeah. So let's go way back. What was happening early on? What was family structure like? And then give me a sense of that, so it gives some context.
Nigerian parents, born in Nigeria, but came to England probably when My dad was 24. My mum was 18 or something.
Okay.
Set up a little community in Nigeria where a few of fellow Nigerians could meet up and reflect and chat and socialize. And I got some pictures of my dad in kipper suits, and I had no idea my dad was that trendy. So that was interesting.
Now, why did they leave?
For opportunity. So my dad was an electrical engineer. He was on a, get this right, I believe he was on a course, like a, what do you call it, like a YTS scheme?
No, so, I don't know what that
is. Okay, so he applied for this job, like an apprenticeship,
okay,
but in Nigeria, and with, I think it was a Siemens, the big German company, mm-hmm. and an opportunity came up in London, and because he'd impressed so well in Nigeria, they offered him the job, which he took, and he then was able to make a home, a base in London.
Okay, so dad was 24, mom was younger.
Yeah.
And was Nigeria, did they struggle with middle class? Were they in the upper tiers? Like, what was the economic structure for your family?
Would have been working class, but working class. Educated.
Educating, working class. Okay. And then some sort of risk taking to leave Nigeria and come to London, or was that the path?
I think that was the path. The opportunities of someone in engineering or even, although be it electrical, seemed to open up more opportunities for my dad.
Now, I don't know this, but I'm curious. Like, when I think of electrical engineering, I think of analytical, logical, sequential thinking, that type of brain and mind.
I don't know. I don't know if, because when I was young, when my dad first came over, I was quite young. I don't even sure I was born at the time, or I wasn't born at the time.
Okay.
My recollection of my dad's was fixing TVs. We'd always have 10, 12 TVs
in the house,
stacked up in the hallway.
Yeah.
And my dad would periodically fix every TV, and then we would have the TVs, because we didn't have TVs at the time. We would have the TVs and watch them for maybe a week or so. Then they would have to go back to once they were repaired. So we would have...
That's a clever way for pops to have TV at the house. Yeah. Right? Yeah, like.
And then I think eventually we got one in our bedroom, me and my brother, black and white, little push button. Probably had to wait 4 or 5 years for that.
Okay.
That was always the sense of growing up. So we couldn't afford what my friends had, but eventually I'd get it. So my dad, so that almost kind of, thinking back, that kind of was a, if you can't afford to have something, you don't go beyond your means, but they'll work to get it for you eventually.
Okay. So the family structure had work ethic, some ingenuity, some sort of cleverness, if you will, and then hope of the future.
Yeah,
like, it's going to work out. So is it fair to say optimistic?
You could say that, but my dad was always big on education. I think you'll find generally Nigerians as a race are quite big on education, get your education right. And that was always a message my dad always say would be, make sure you can be around any conversation. So you can discuss whether it's politics, whether it's sport, whether it's business. Make sure you can contribute.
Okay. And did you do traditional school?
Yes.
You did.
So I have three brothers, one sister. All of us grew up in Hackney, North London.
Mm-hmm. You said North.
North.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That slang is the accent, like, yeah.
Yeah. It's mellowed in time.
Yeah.
So we were quite a close family. We'd have birthday cakes and we'd look after each other and look out for each other. So I've got an older brother, older sister. I'm in the middle. So I've got a younger brother, two younger brothers. So I was kind of, I got to see some of the good stuff and bad stuff. So my sister was a solicitor. She was always studying. My brother was a little bit in and out of trouble. So he was a bit of a bad boy, but a popular boy. So I got to see that I got to see both sides. So in essence, I did reasonably well at school without being teacher's pet.
Okay, so you didn't cross either line.
I probably danced over either line and came back. Okay. And found some sort of middle ground.
And then, so I've never asked this question, but you're conjuring up something really cool for me right now, which is Nigerian family, high value in education so that you can communicate in any group of people, right? And then you've got this model of brothers. Who were you trying to fit in with? And that's a loaded question because maybe you weren't trying to fit in, but I've never asked that question. Like, what was the guiding thought about you as a youngster trying to sort out you?
It's a good question. I don't ever think I tried to be either, because I remember at the time I was quite good at sports.
Okay, so that was part of early identity.
Yeah, but my sister was also. Mm-hmm. But then I played for teams, and my brothers didn't, and my sister didn't. Maybe I was just right at the time when sort of team sports was more popular with kids that age. And I think I found early success. So I'd won stuff as a youngster. Like
how old?
Probably 10, 11, 12. From then onwards, I was always... I guess I wasn't always into football. It wasn't until about 8, and one of my brother's friends took me around the local cage where it used to be. You know, you'd have to dodge the bits of glass and the bits of dog shit. And you could get on the cage.
What is a cage?
It's like a metal area where you could play football. They had goals.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
So what would you call that like in the States?
Well, I'm not sure. Like glass and dog shit in a cage. I'm not sure what we call that. Look, okay. I'm trying to sort that out myself. Okay, so you had early success and he was bringing you around some places.
No, so this was before, sorry. So the first time I really loved football was about 8 years old. Nothing to do really. So we'd play and hang out on the street. And then my brother's mate took me where all my older brother's friends were and my brother, and they'd play football. Mm. So this it was an area probably a size of a quarter of a pitch, maybe a bit smaller, but it was concrete.
Like a blacktop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So then they had a goal painted on the wall or on the fence, which was, you know, both ends. And then you just played football until it got dark. And it wasn't until about then I fell in love.
So that's 8, 9 in that range? Yeah, ages? Okay. So the early success, is that something you understand? Did you live through the ups and the downs of early success? Because there's some traps in there that I'm blown away by. Early success can be incredible for this false sense of confidence because you never have to earn confidence because everyone tells you you're special. And then also a sense of entitlement can come with it. So those are the two traps for early success.
I've never really looked at it. I've never tried to detail it.
Okay, so if we back into that, what was your level of confidence playing? 1 to 10.
If I take it back, so at school we did cross country, we did hockey, we did cricket, we did football. And I was fairly successful at most of those. So they'd give out medals, I'd be in the top three.
Okay.
So I wouldn't call that success. That's, I don't know, what would you call that?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's that's part of, but it's not like international success.
Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't like
right.
that.
This
it
is like local neighborhood success, right? So it was I'd say it sounds like you were forming your identity around that you can do things physically pretty well.
Yes.
Right? And then people would give you some attention for that as well.
Yeah.
And then so you would try harder, maybe.
Yeah, possibly. The rewards were were trophies.
Mm-hmm.
And then my we'd have friends around, my parents would show off their son.
Your parents
my son would.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like any normal parents.
What was that like for you when your folks would show other people your trophies?
it probably started off a little bit, how would you say it? I guess the word I'm looking for is it was probably more of a God, not again, Mum. It was a bit cringy.
Embarrassing.
Yeah.
So that's a word I had, like, I didn't have the words you had, but I do remember being doubted on or being doted. What's the word? I remember doted. Yeah. Being doted on about like something special. I would get really embarrassed because it was never about that for me. I didn't care. I don't know if you cared, but did you care about,
I wanted to win. I enjoyed the feeling of, I found it more that, when I would probably, didn't know it at the time, but I would probably work harder than the other one, or I was very determined. And also, I think, I'm trying to put this into context where this happened during my childhood. It was about 9, 10, 11, 12. Between the ages of 9 and 12, we got burgled.
Burgled?
Yeah, so.
Robbed?
Yeah.
The family.
Yes, the house. Right. So I remember being a kid because I was it might have been 11. And I got back from school. The front door was open. I looked and it was obvious we'd been burgled. So I didn't go in. I called, went to the, these were the days when you had to go to the phone box. And I called the police. It took them it took them 5 hours to turn up. So,
are you in a bad neighborhood?
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
It was in an inner city neighborhood.
Right? Yeah.
So, and then when they did finally turn up, I think they spent probably about 2 minutes. And I remember watching from the pavement, looking at that, and I knew then that there was an inequality about being black, about life. I think the life thing was probably the big, because in my head, I've always had this thing that, if that had been a slightly different neighborhood or my next door neighbor who was white, who we got on really well with, would that have been different? That was always a question that came into my head.
As an 11-year-old?
Yeah.
What was the emotional part of that for you? Because you just gave us the thinking part, but what is the emotional part?
There was an unjustness about it. There was rage. I was left to pick up the pieces. And I think part of me almost wanted to, I think we tidied up the house before Mum and Dad got back to a degree. So they wouldn't have seen too much of that because my mum would have, I know my mum even to this day, over-exaggerates everything, every reaction. I think that's just what mums do. I remember thinking, I don't want them to see this.
Wow, at 11. Was that a compassion?
I don't know what it was. I think because we always got home and they always worked fairly late, and I think Mum worked maybe two or three jobs at times.
Yeah.
I can't remember real clearly on the spot today, but there was definitely a period when my dad would get back about 6, 7 o'clock. My mum would get back about 5-ish. But they'd be gone from the house before we left school.
How did this shape you?
I not knowing at the time, I found a resilience of sorts. It stays in my head, that memory of that incident that day. And the drip feeding that my dad would always say, look after the pennies, the pounds, look after themselves. So, save your money now, don't spend it all, and enjoy yourself, but think about the future. Be able to have a conversation in any topic. Live by yourself first, don't rely on any woman or anybody. It wasn't particularly a woman, it was don't rely on anyone. And my dad would often have little conversations with us. I mean, there were times when we couldn't speak. So when the wrestling was on, WWF, he loved wrestling. When the 6 o'clock news was on, or the 9 o'clock news, you couldn't speak. But outside of that, he would find out what we'd done on the day. And then every now and again, it wasn't all the time, but every now and again, he would sit us down and then he'd know, he'd just say stuff. And for some reason, I'd take it on board.
Okay, so dad, mom and dad were influential in shaping you. This experience, of all the things that you could have brought up, you brought up this experience, was influential in shaping you. You figured out some injustice, some rage, and you took that to say it actually helped build resiliency, right? And dad helped me kind of maybe put sense of this together, this resiliency thing together. Have you heard of post-traumatic growth?
No.
Oh, so you likely have heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, when people go to war or see something heavy, like traumatically heavy, is that it can be very, very difficult to assimilate back to normal life. But there is such a thing called post-traumatic growth. So you go through something very heavy, and then but you come out the other side of it stronger. And resiliency is that psychological factor underneath of it. And then so how has that played well for you, both the concept of injustice, racial injustice, as well as this idea, I figure things out?
There was never any, I think as I grew up, there couldn't have been much of an injustice, as opposed to maybe it was more of a, you need to know this and you need to be armed for it.
Okay.
Because there was never really
like
a chip, like fucking the police are racist.
Yeah,
I knew there was definitely an equality, but there was never really a bitterness.
Okay,
which there could have been.
It could have been.
I don't know why that was, but
yeah, because they didn't take care of you, but you didn't generalize that to all white people, right? You said, okay, there's something here that I got to pay attention to.
Yeah.
That's a pretty clever, smart, aware, switched on kid that we're talking about. You, right? And so, how many other Nigerians, or would you say Africans were playing in the league when you got in? So I think you were relatively early in that experience.
Probably would have been. There had been Cyril Regis, Laurie Cunningham at the club previously, but that was in the 80s, 70s, 80s. I've never really given it any thought, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
So maybe there was, let's say there was one or two in London clubs or at clubs. I was 120 miles from London. And I'd been in the demographic of where I was had changed quite a lot. So London was quite multicultural, whereas I came to West Bromwich in Birmingham, or in the West Midlands, and I was with a white family who had a dog. We had cats. We never had. I mean, not that I had anything against dogs, but they had a dog.
The way you said it's like.
I mean, the dog was a fucking giant. It was a
Great Dane.
Yeah. I mean, it was a giant. It's a giant.
How tall are you?
6'2".
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But so that wasn't ever like a thing, like, whoa, I'm one of the only Africans playing in the sport in my town or whatever. That wasn't part of it.
No. It's weird. It's quite strange. There was a part of me that always thought growing up I was different. Like I had reason to be a lot more negative about stuff. But I chose a different method. A lot of the times I felt I was able to bridge certain gaps, if that makes sense.
No.
Right. So some of my mates were black, used to have issues with some of the white friends. Now I'd see what that issue was and I'd explain to both of them. So
so you have a skill.
So that's
the
gap.
You have a skill. And is this just, not just, but is this primarily with people that you're able to see perspective from many angles and close those gaps?
I try to affect something that I feel I can, and I've not thought about it enough to be able to break it down and say, well, yeah, it's this. But now you've said that, I think there are times when I've done that, where I've bridged a sort of a gap.
Okay, I'm trying to sort out how you've been so successful in so many different clubs, right? Which is rare. That's extraordinary. And what I'm kind of filtering in the back of my mind right now is, okay, so you had some brothers that kind of showed you some stuff and you learned, but you're really aware young kid. You didn't get controlled by your emotions. You move through things. You're still able to continue to grow. You had a natural talent and you worked really hard. Those are some basic frames, and the resiliency is threaded throughout. And then what else? Like, what is the thing? Here's the question. Sorry to get to the question. I don't know if you can answer this and sound humble, and I get a sense that you are that, but maybe not. I don't know. What is it that makes you really special?
Special as in different to how other people would react in the same circumstance, then yes, I can see why you'd say that was special. I think once I commit to something, I don't like to. I like to see it through, or I like to have done it to the best of my ability. I think that's one. I believe in right's right. So regardless of the outcome or of the what's at stake. So I liken it to a football game sometimes. So I'll be on the line, on the verge of, but I won't cross it for absolutely anything. But then afterwards, I'll smile, and I'd like to think I wouldn't cross it, or I'd like to think I would treat me how I'd like to be treated. So I guess there's some real basics in that, but then also, I don't know, there's a drive in me that sometimes can be a weakness, I think, because it doesn't almost allow me to sometimes, are there instances where you should walk away, or are there instances where you say, well, I've done all I can, but I don't know. I think there's always a bright spark or a positive side in everything. So we have some of our players can be shits. They can be arrogant little fuckers, and they can be rude. And I think I try and break it down. Why have they done that? What's gone on through his day or through his life that has made him that way? Because at some point he's been molded by someone else.
You're really reflective. You think a lot.
Yeah.
And you don't get caught by your thoughts. You don't overanalyze. You're still able to put thoughts aside when it's time to do and execute.
Yeah, I think I need to be better at certain aspects of it. Yeah, okay. But I think as a whole, I am quite a deep thinker.
And so, do you have a spiritual framework?
I'm a God fearing. I'm not. I wouldn't say I'm religious. I don't necessarily go to church. I've lit candles before. Mm-hmm. I pray from time to time. I donate to charities. Mm-hmm. So there's no. I'd describe myself as a good person.
And then how do you finish this thought? It all comes down to. I like your grin.
Yeah. I'm trying to. That's such a terrific point that you've just laid out there.
Yeah. I'm fascinated like where you're going to take it.
So, sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, it all comes down to.
being Ugo Ekyog.
And what does that mean? So that's a cool question. Like, who are you? And that's like this fundamental question that I like to ask myself every day. Like, Mike, seriously, who are you?
I think I've given you a, I've described the, as much as I possibly probably could have. There's still parts of me that's still molding, that's still, I'm not sure. But what it will have is, it will, there will be some fun, there'll be hard work, there'll be happiness, and I'm sure there'll be some tears along the way, not too many, but there'll be a lot of love as well. And through, for a number of avenues, I have no doubt at some point I'll find out.
Okay. So this is an incredible conversation. Thank you for being honest, for being open, for sharing. There's so much more to learn from you. And then really quickly, when you look back, what is the one word that captures your professional life?
Blessed.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing this time.
It's been a pleasure. It's actually a genuine shame that I actually have to go, because I think I could, there's stuff that's coming out that I probably hadn't given thought of how I've got to it or why I've done it.
Yeah, this is decoding, deconstructing like the path of mastery. And you know what maybe we'll do? Why don't we do something like this? Why don't we reconnect over Skype? I'll get back to the States. We'll reconnect over Skype and we'll do like a part A, part B.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, brother. Take care. Thank you, Ugo, for the time we spent, for sharing your insights and reminding me, reminding us all now of how important it is to love. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.